Good morning. I was touched to see how helpful people are. Nothing's that easy, and it's even these little simple things with help with lighting the candle, a little bit of guidance about what to expect and what to do. It's just so nice to have. People sometimes think as the minister that I would be able to do all of the other jobs in church, that I must have earned my way here by knowing how to do all that, like how to be a board president or how to set up the chairs. I haven't a clue. I'm completely dependent on others for that. But here's one of the most dramatic crowd scenes from the story of the ministry of Jesus as told by the evangelist Matthew. Now when Jesus heard of the death of John the Baptist, he withdrew in a boat to a lonely place apart. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. So it must have been like Seattle or something where it's quicker to go by boat, but they did the long way around. We can see that the people are sticking close to Jesus, the master rabbi, and his disciples, following on foot to that place that's easier to reach by boat. They won't let him out of their sight, not even to mourn the death of John the Baptist. Something's always happening with this Jesus party, sights and wonders. Everybody's hungry for what's going to happen next. As he went ashore, he saw a great throng, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. When it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a lonely place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves." The disciples want Jesus to solve the problem. They assume he knows how to do everything, right? Solve the problem by sending the people away to take care of themselves. Mark's version of the story has the disciples start kvetching, saying more or less, "What, we're supposed to spend the whole kitty of coins we've pooled to take care of ourselves just to buy one meal for these jokers?" But their master turns the problem back to his students. "Don't complain to me. You feed them." Jesus said, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." They said, "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish. In the old King James Version, it was 2 fishes, which confused me as a kid. I just learned that the plural of fish is fish, and then I was learning something different in church than I learned in school. But 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and he said, "Bring them here to me." Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass, and taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke, and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. Jesus plainly has more than the attention of the crowd. He has them enthralled. With a mere gesture of his head, he refers the people from their present situation to heaven, a reality that transcends the ordinary reality of hunger in the present moment, transcends them while also holding them all together. Nothing strange here. Not for a crowd of believing Jews gathered with their rabbi for a meal. Bread and Torah, right? Nothing unusual yet. But here comes the unusual part. The crowd receives the broken loaves and fishes from the disciples, and they all ate and were satisfied. They took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces left over, and those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. What more can we say about this unusual meal? Or is it enough to just tell the story? Let's ponder while Deborah plays. Thank you. Thinking about all that dry food makes me a little thirsty. They all ate and were satisfied. Then they took up 12 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. And those who ate were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. I love that. What are we supposed to make of this? Did Jesus feed these people with really, really, really big loaves of bread? Maybe they were from the bakery that used to supply giants like Goliath, who little David beat with a stone. Plus some kind of huge fish that's now extinct, like the one that swallowed Jonah. Or maybe this is one of those translation problems where the word for fish in Greek can also mean whale. It could be, but I doubt it. Did he have a replicator machine like on Star Trek? Donna? Donna made our chalice. It is a Star Trek fan. So maybe he was a space alien or a visitor from the future bringing great new technology. Some think Jesus spent time in Tibet learning mysterious techniques from Buddhist masters. Not too likely, but I do think that the ongoing contact between the religions of the West and the East suggests some new ways to see and hear the story of the loaves and fishes. I can't do the many religious approaches of the East justice today, but I think that it's safe to say that they seem to, one, cultivate a calm regard for the things of the world, and two, preach an attitude of non-attachment to those things. Craving for more of those things than we need. Cravings are the major source of suffering, and their stranglehold on our lives can be loosened when we take a good hard look at what they really are. We might tentatively read something like this into the gospel story when Jesus blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds, and they all ate and were satisfied. They were satisfied. They ate until they experienced satisfaction. Is it possible that something in what Jesus and the disciples did permitted the people in the crowd to feel satisfaction, even if they did not eat until their stomachs were actually full? Was this a mass experience of something like a temporary Buddhist enlightenment? Did people suddenly stop craving more than they actually received, more than the tiny morsels 5,000 plus people would have had to share, eating from 5 loaves and 2 fishes? Was Jesus able to share with them all at once the fruit of years and years of meditation and teach them all in one day how to eliminate craving for more than what one receives? Who knows? Maybe Jesus did study such things in Tibet or wherever. Or maybe the people were satisfied because just once, everyone had the same amount, the same tiny morsels, and no one had a bite more than another. They looked to themselves, and they looked at each other, and all that they saw and they felt was enough for now. Meaning that the real miracle in our story is this. One day, we were satisfied all together. We experienced the miracle of enough. We all shared a morsel and we didn't want more. It was a moment of perfect balance. It was a moment for the ages, a moment that touched the eternal, but not a moment that could last forever. Moments don't do that, even when they seem to. Such moments are rare in the lives of individuals or communities. We wait a lifetime for them to come, and then they go. Jesus himself called this one to an end. He made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. Now that you've seen and felt and tasted enough together, now you've seen it, you've tasted it. Enough of that for today. Enough religious intensity. Now take the experience home. If you don't go home with the lesson, it won't really be complete. But I question now whether the whole crowd would have gone home, or if some would have continued to follow, hanging close to the Jesus scene, waiting for the next thing to happen. After all, they've just walked the long way to a place better reached by boat, just to keep up with them. Something was always in the air, waiting to happen. It was electric. Probably a fair number of those people had little to go home to, little to eat or to do or to hope for. But they've tasted the mystery of enough. And now, like fishes themselves, they're hooked on the intensity of the experience. They are intensity junkies, like many of us today. Sometimes we hardly care what the feeling or experience is, so long as it's intense. The next crowd scenes find us in Jerusalem, at or near the Second Temple, a walled compound big enough to hold 400,000 people. It's Passover time, so there's a full house. Jesus is feeding his audience stories this time, and the last story he will ever tell in public, he tells today. It's about food and kindness and hospitality being offered to someone called the Son of Man, who sounds very important. And also about some people called the least of these, who at first sound quite unimportant, but soon we'll see that this is not the case. The Son of Man will say, "Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." And then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and minister to you?" And the Son of Man will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." This parable doesn't seem to require much explanation. What part of "do it for the least of these and you do it for me" don't we understand? Maybe there's more than we think. In another page or two, the Last Supper is over and Jesus has been arrested, and we come to the next crowd scene on what's now called Good Friday, and the story tells us the darkness fell at noon. Jesus was brought before the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, and as he stood there, the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "The words are yours," said Jesus. And to the charges laid against him by the chief priests and elders, he made no reply. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear all this evidence that's brought against you?" But still he refused to answer one word. You follow this? According to the gospel, Jesus' very last public statement was to say, "The words are yours." In other words, he's done spelling things out for us in his words. He's done talking. Good rabbi knows when to stop. But the story continues. At the festival season, it was the governor's custom to release one prisoner chosen by the people. There was then in custody a man of some notoriety called Jesus Barabbas. Jesus Barabbas. When they were assembled, Pilate said to him, "Which would you like me to release to you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus called Messiah?" asked Pilate. And with one voice, They all answered, Barabbas. Then what am I to do with Jesus called Messiah? Asked Pilate. And with one voice they answered, Crucify him. Why? What harm has he done? Pilate asked. But they shouted all the louder, Crucify him. On the day of crucifixion, Jesus is one of a group of three. Two are tied to crosses. Only he is nailed. The scene reminds me of an extreme sports event or one of those reality shows on TV. I don't go for such rah-rah stuff. The crowd shouting out their demands and MCs yelling who's in or out. I get offended by Christian symbols plastered on people's cars as if they were promoting their favorite sports team. I'm particularly miffed when someone with a fish on the bumper of their holy SUV cuts me off in traffic. Those are some fishes I wish had never multiplied. But there's one bumper sticker that I don't mind because it's a question instead of an answer. Not that idiotic one that asks, got Jesus, as if he was a product to buy. But the one that asks, what would Jesus do? It's not a bad question at all. What would Jesus do? You can be certain that Jesus wouldn't do what a loud minority of so-called Christians do, like leading campaigns against gay people's rights, shooting doctors or bombing clinics where abortions are performed, among many other services, supporting any war if someone slaps a cross on it. But let's take this good question back to where Pilate asks the people to choose between Jesus called Messiah or Jesus Barabbas, the condemned criminal. Matthew says he was notorious, but the Gospels of Mark and Luke tell us that Jesus Barabbas had committed murder during an insurgency against the Roman occupation. Today he'd be called a terrorist, at least by the Romans. But now let's ask ourselves the question. How would you choose if you were in the crowd when Pilate called for the crowd's decision? Which Jesus would you choose? As for me, I don't call myself a Christian, and I don't plan to take part in any team sport where you slap fish or flags on things and call that faith. But what if I'd been part of the crowd outside the prison that day? Would I have been shouting for Jesus, the master rabbi, or for Jesus Barabbas, the notorious guy? Pilate's the one who's got Jesus for the moment, two Jesuses with one to spare. Which Jesus do we want? Which one do we ask for? Here's another question. Where are the master's disciples right now? And where are the others, the crowds who followed them around? Matthew tells us that sometime between this crowd scene and the last one, the disciples ran away. He tells us that even the beloved Apostle Peter, when asked if he knew his master, denied him three times, saying, I don't know, man. That's exactly what Jesus expected Peter to do, and he told him so. Which makes the guess that I'll now share with you seem less outlandish. My guess is that among the people in the mob now shouting, give us Barabbas, are many from the multitude who'd enjoyed those loaves and fishes earlier. We saw before how determined they were to stay close to the Jesus action with all its intensity. Maybe they expect a miracle now. Maybe suddenly we'll see Judas, Pilate, and the high priest on the crosses where the condemned men were before. That would make a hit movie today, and no doubt would have wowed the crowd back then. But it would make of Jesus little more than the world's greatest magician. And he was both less and more than that. Let's keep imagining. Let's assume that Jesus could use whatever powers he had just one more time. Let's accept for a moment the orthodox position that Jesus could at once be God in heaven and the Son of Man on earth. Couldn't he also be at one and the same time on the cross and off of it, one among the crowd? Let's imagine that he can. And now when Pilate appears to ask the crowd if he should release Jesus called Messiah or Jesus Barabbas the murderer, what would the Son of Man do? Who would Jesus choose? We know that he would choose Barabbas. Even non-Christians, like most of us, have a clear idea of Jesus, though we don't worship in his name. He would call for Barabbas along with the crowd. And if we were his disciples and we were there, whom would he want us to choose? It's our last choice to make before the story ends. The gospel story, like all the best ones, is our story too. And who are we? Favorite disciples, do you think? Multitude or mob? Are we the people who want it all? The people who cry for loaves and fishes and Barabbas? Always happy to help ourselves to a miracle and wash it down with water turned to wine. We'll gulp down your miracles of satisfaction today, then turn on you if you don't satisfy us tomorrow. We want the good things of what Jesus has called the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world, but reject those he called the least of these, my brethren. Jesus told us just the day before that if we want to choose the Son of Man, we must choose the people called the least of these. And who could be less than Barabbas? Matthew says he was notorious. Mark and Luke speak of murder or terrorism. He'd be the last on most people's list of worthy human beings. But the last on Jesus' list comes, "I was in prison, and you came to me. Truly, I say to you that as you did it to one of the least of these, you did it to me." The least of these, the very least, those who are not enough to be worth saving. As our children's story would put it, the last and least of all the cats, the one that's not even pretty in its own eyes, that has no beauty even to itself. Imagine how that feels. The least of these. That was his final lesson. He would only say at his trial that the next words must be ours. He has said enough. Jesus is silent today. He's taught us how to choose already, and the best teachers won't allow themselves to be drawn into endless repetitions and explanations. But I'm a lesser teacher, so I'll go ahead and risk putting words into the mouth that said enough already. Yesterday we ate the loaves and fishes, drank water turned to wine, and knew it was enough. Today we share the scraps and dregs from the bottom of the barrel. The least of these is being taken to the cross. To save the Son of Man, save the least of these right now. Don't you dare say, "Jesus saves." You must save Jesus Barabbas. Just means the son of his father in Aramaic. Not some abstract son of man or the superpowered son of God. Those sick, hungry, thirsty prisoners born of human parents with specific names, call for them right now. I've brought eyesight to the blind, called the dead back to life, but when you choose Jesus the outlaw, Jesus the loser, you'll have more power than Jesus the Master. Give comfort to the last of the least of these. When you can do that, you'll have no need of me. You took the loaves and fishes and were satisfied. But then you shouted, "Give us Barabbas." The words are yours, and this is what they mean. When you truly choose the least of these, then you will have enough. When you can ask in truth for what you ask in scorn today, then you shall have it. Loaves and fishes and Barabbas, you shall have them all. You shall have them all. What do you think? Is it likely that Jesus would say things like this? Maybe it's just as likely that he studied in Tibet or was the representative of a superior future civilization in a time that's coming for the human family. That's coming. A time when the least of these are saved from the crosses of the violence we inflict and the violence of our neglect. When our hands reach out and our voices cry together, no more crosses, no more border walls, no death or torture in my name, no thirst and no starvation, no crosses today, none tomorrow, and none forevermore. Well, plainly, that time has not yet come. But I hope it does come soon. If the passion for justice has died in any of us, I hope it can be resurrected. And today, I share this hope with you. Happy Easter, one and all, from you and yours to the last of the least among us. Amen.